I would like to point out that there are some hecklers that have joined the crowd. So, yeah, there we go. First of all, let me thank Sue and PLS for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to speak to you. NYLA is an important organization, and the New York Library Association is something that I think we all should continuously work to make sure that it remains strong. It represents the voice of our community and ultimately helps improve our status within the state and nationally. I'm sure you're hearing a lot about what's happening in New York State. You're hearing a lot about what's happening next door. I would like to talk to you a little bit about what's happening nationally and what's happening internationally. The other thing I love about presenting at really strong conferences like this is that you have plenty of opportunities for real content, so I don't feel in any way obligated to give you more. So I'm just going to sort of talk about some ideas and such, and we'll see where it goes. The publisher of Community, where that comes from. So I was next door in Vermont. I was actually not going to tell you the state, but I've already done it. So I was next door in Vermont, and they were doing a rollout of a broadband stimulus grant. So they had, with the Gates Foundation, with the State Department, with the State Library, gone to the federal government, and back when stimulus wasn't an evil word, gotten some funding to bring broadband connections to rural libraries all across the state. And there are some rural libraries all across the state. They did a kickoff. They invited me to come to the kickoff, but they started with some discussions, and they were encountering some resistance. So what the grant was to do was to drop about 200-plus of these rural libraries. They were going to drop high-speed gigabit Ethernet at their doorstep, fiber. Now, for those of you who aren't geeks, gigapop means whoa, right? It means like, let's just watch lots of Netflix. But they were having trouble sort of communicating this to folks who had a pretty good free dial-up connection, or they had, they were paying $100 a year for something like, a half megabit per second walking down the pipe, and now they're going to be asked to pay, I'm not kidding you, like $150 a year to get gigabit Ethernet. Right? And so they're, sitting there and being Vermont-like, which is picturesque but slightly stoic, and saying, I don't know. I don't know if I want to. Not in my backyard. And so a person got up. She was clearly very frustrated with this discussion. And she said, look, I don't think you get what is being offered here. She goes, think of your internet connection now like a country road. Right? This is what's coming into your library. And she goes, we're going to drop off, and when we're done, you're going to have the Autobahn coming into your library. Right? And you could tell that she was very proud of this metaphor. But then you'd look around the crowd, and you would see all these rather stoic, picturesque Vermonters go, because, what they see of the Autobahn coming to their library, this is the image that instantly pops up to their mind, right? Which is, oh, God, all this traffic hurrying at me faster, and I don't know what to do with it, and I'll never be able to sort it out. And so my job was to get up and say, it's okay. And to say that you have to sort of think about things differently, that this isn't about bringing lots of stuff into your library. This is about giving you an immense and huge opportunity to get things in your community out to the world, to, in essence, inflict Vermonters upon the world. Right? And to begin to get them to talk about, it's not oncoming traffic you're worried about, that's great, but we're worried about sending things out. They had a great story. I love to tell this. I have students in the audience, I told them to go to the other session because I only have three stories and they've heard all three before. So there is a gentleman in Vermont who loved snowmobiles. He had, he'd buy them and he'd buy extras of them and he'd buy four more, and this one was broken so it was cheap, so he'd buy not a lot of them. And he ended up, by the time he retired, with a barn full of broken snowmobiles. And so over one break, his grandson came in, took a camera and a computer, and inventoried all, with his permission, all of his snowmobile parts. And overnight put up a shop in front of them going, need a snowmobile part. And it turns out that in Siberia, quite literally Siberia, they have lots of broken snowmobiles and they can't find any parts for it. So overnight this guy with a barn full of broken snowmobiles became a worldwide snowmobile distributor. Right? Which is a really cool story. And you need the Autobahn going out for that story, not coming in. And so what I started, that really got me thinking and cogitating and worrying about this idea of what the reaction these librarians were having. It's not a unique reaction to Vermonters. Right? When you look at broadband, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pressure to get broadband everywhere, but you know, there's still lots within our community, even in enlightened New York, that sit there and go, really? You know, why? How is that going to help me? How much is it going to cost? What's the value? And what I finally came to the conclusion of is that we were really encountering a I think, pervasive and frankly dangerous perspective on librarianship, which is that the librarianship is a consumer activity. That in essence, we look at libraries as places where we store, where we buy, where we leverage dollars, where we go and we collect and we organize and we purchase and we get stuff. And that our main job is about the stuff and the getting of stuff. And what's more, we get the stuff for our community. And that often means that we're getting things that are not of the community. In other words, we're getting the stuff to give the community access to. The analogy I give is it's kind of like leading with your back to the crowd, right? If you want to know what good stuff is, let's look everywhere else but behind us where we're standing. You're not a consumer. Librarians are not super consumers. If what you came out of library school knowing was how to do really good Amazon purchasing, we have failed. Right? If what we've come out is that you can wrangle a really good deal, we have failed. And we're going to increasingly fail our communities if all we become is a bargain shopping bin. If we become the place that gets cheap materials and cheap books, or they're not cheap at all, but at least we can get one of them instead of 50 of them, this entire line of reasoning where libraries are sort of like the Walmart of the information world. Come here. It's easy. We'll have a greeter. Right? As opposed to what's really happening, which is, what about us broadcasting out? What about us capturing the community's content? What about us becoming publishers of our community? When people come to our library not to learn about other places, but they come to our library to learn about our communities. Now, it sounds great, but I want to make a real example of this. I want to play a game with you. And the game is, can you identify where in the world this library is from? So we'll start with this picture. Anyone? This is Philadelphia. This is at the Central Library in Philadelphia. This is their music reading room, and we're going to come back to this picture. All right, we'll start out with an easy one. I'll give you a hint. We can zoom in on the shelves. It's Dewey. This is Zambia. Ready? Next one. It's pretty. Good furniture. IKEA-esque. Nope. This is Alberta in Canada. This one's pretty. Anyone? South Africa. This is Cape Town. This is where the IKEA would have helped you. This is Helsinki. Right? One more. Right? This is Saudi Arabia. Now, the reason I walk you through this pictures is because, one, ooh, look, pictures. And frankly, they're not exciting pictures, right? This isn't the pictures that we like to ooh and ah our crowd with. This isn't the one where you entice students into the MLS by showing them the massive books, right? These are like, you know, really? This is going to inspire the world. Really? Desks. Ooh, ah, neutral carpeting. But the reason I bring this up is I actually had a brilliant doctoral student, Sarah Webb, and she did a lot of work in Africa. She worked at the Seattle Public Library, and then she went into Rwanda and Namibia and in Africa, and she'd walk into public libraries and she would go, wait a minute, I'm not just a continent away, I'm worlds away, and it looks the same. Right? If you look back through those pictures, as a librarian, you could walk into those buildings and walk behind that desk, right? You could say, oh, the stacks, information desk, I get it. Somewhere there'll be seats where people are looking at porn and we're trying not to, right? You know, this is good, but you're really looking at it going, what a dusty nightmare. I know what you're thinking, right? And then over here, this is cool. All right. We never are going to get the furniture budget we need to do that. And, you know, those are going to get out of date too soon. And the printer is going to be broken somewhere. My point with all of these pictures is that the Dewey Decimal System was based on one guy's, misogynistic anti-Semite guy's view of how the world could be organized. And here we find it in Zambia. This is a primarily oral culture. This is a culture that is only now becoming accustomed to books. And for years, what they looked at libraries were colonial institutions. They were primarily segregated. The majority of these books and materials are about kids in France and England, not in Zambia, whatever. Right? Why is it that this model of building with books and an information desk is so pervasive? Why is it that we're assuming that somewhere they're having a committee meeting about technical services? We're assuming, right, somewhere there's a discussion about library cards and who's allowed to have them, right? You know, it's happening all over the world. And why is that? Well, you know, I think it's because, well, first of all, in Zambia, it has a lot to do with UNESCO and the fact that a bunch of developed countries got together and said, this is what a library looks like, and if you want to be developed, this is what it should look like. And they base the model on consumption. We buy books, we get books, people give us books, we hope they don't give us those books, God help us, National Geographic shows up again, whatever it is. And we put them on shelves. And then we need places for people to sit. Right? But I want to show you some other libraries. This is a library I was just in Salzburg. Right? Did anyone see The Sound of Music? I stayed at the house. Right? You remember the scene where Maria and the kids were coming over the water to meet the Baroness, and they fall in the water, and the captain is not pleased? Right? I stayed there. Right? My wife heard that. She was, I'm coming! I'm like, all right, fine. Right? Anyway, this is the library inside. And what's very interesting about this is it was based actually on a Swedish library. They had it built, you know, specially for this facility to look like it. But what I want you to notice is the architecture. The books are along the side, and in the middle are the tables where people can collaborate. Right? Now, I've showed you this picture because even though it looks really classic and old, right now Corinne Hill, who's the director of the Dallas Public Library, is redoing all of her branches around the same concept. As she said, we put the collaborative spaces in the middle, and we put the books like art around the outside. Now, some people hear we put the books like art on the outside and they say, oh, no, they're just decoration. They're just there to look good. And the answer is you obviously don't know what art means, because art isn't just about decoration. Art for centuries is how we provoke, how we communicate, how we inspire, how we show emotion, how we've communicated. For centuries, art was the way in which we formed a conversation with our communities about what culture meant, what our communities meant, what we saw, what it looked like. And so by talking about books around the outside like art, it's not to say they're decorative. It's to say this is where the work happens. And this is where the inspiration, the provoking, the understanding, the culture comes from to help aid and accelerate that conversation. If you recall, I started with this picture of Philadelphia. Now, I don't know if when clinical definition of hoarder kicks in, but it might be, well, when you've built the stacks along the structural columns and then you put more books along there, right? It's a clinical diagnosis. I want to show you, this picture was taken about 3 years ago. I want to show you the same room taken in the 1940s. Same room. All right? This concept of building full of books, more books and more books and more books, is actually a relatively recent concept. Now, what's interesting is we've all talked in public libraries about our boards, right? Our boards love libraries, but they really love libraries of when they were 9 years old, right? Well, when they were 9 years old, they looked like this, right? Oh, I love going in and getting lost in the stacks. You mean lost in the stacks? That's a liability nightmare. No! But what we had is we had a mission gone wrong. We had a mission of librarians when we built this, where these were the key central figures. And our mission was to get them as much information as possible to do this work. But we kind of forgot, and we focused on this. And what happened in the 1940s and 1950s is paper prices dropped, printing prices dropped, production of publications rose dramatically, and we kept getting it. Right? It's like alcoholism, insanity, the same thing, over and over again, expecting a different result, right? Like somehow these books were going to self-sort. And now they end up, we have basements we don't show people. We have bins that are waiting for vans, and we can't get the vans fast enough. And there, we have, in University of Texas at Austin, they have this wonderful spire. And it turns out that the University of Austin is blessed, the University of Texas at Austin is blessed with oil money. There was a great deal that profits from the oil assets in Texas would go towards the universities. But it would only go towards capital projects. It could not be put into salaries. So what this meant is when the oil was booming, particularly in the 70s, they just bought stuff. They have like a Gutenberg Bible in Texas, right? Which, when you think about it, Bible, Texas, kind of makes sense, but I'm not sure about the Gutenberg size. They walked, they filled this clock tower full of boxes and boxes of stuff that they bought that they didn't know what it was. They didn't know where to put it. How many of you have found yourself in a situation where you went into the back room, you opened the box, and you went, what the hell is this? And then you did, not my problem, and you walked away, right? And come on. This idea of consumerism, of us collecting things and bringing things together and buying other stuff and purchasing other stuff, has become so ingrained in our DNA that it's almost hard for us to think about what else. So I wrote a book, Atlas of New Librarianship. Go buy it. It's great. But anyway, in there I said, can we imagine a library that doesn't have books, that doesn't have stuff? And people came back and said, oh, there's no library without materials. There's no library without a collection. Right? And I said, think about how many e-books that you're now buying. Are you really moving down to within 10 years, frankly, your collection will look like that? Right? So it won't be an empty library. It'll have a Kindle in it. But it's the same idea. What are you going to do with the space? What are you going to do with that area? Right? If you're in collection and buying mode, that's really confusing. But if you think about what our original mission is, it's not so much. So you go, all right, Dave, if it's not the stuff, what is it? Here's a shot of the Learning Commons from the University of Kentucky. Learning Commons is big in academic libraries and increasingly being used in public libraries. The notion is that you have collaborative spaces and you co-locate services. So in academia, we co-locate reference, and we co-locate computer support, we co-locate tutoring services. But what's great in public libraries, they're co-locating library services and entrepreneurship services and job-seeking services and all these different kinds of services together. Notice there is not a piece of furniture that isn't on a wheel that they can't move and they can't reconfigure and they can't think about. So, yeah, all right, great, that's fine, I can do that. But, with, you know, still, they got a space. You know the books are hiding. Where are they? So I want to give you another one. What if your library looked like this? This is a library. In Kenya, the National Library Service is building libraries as fast as they can. They're building them in urban centers, and they're building them in rural populations. But the rural populations, where the roads run out, as they do, they actually have built wooden carts to carry 5,000 books pulled by donkeys. And when the donkeys run out, they use camels. There are places in northern Kenya that are so remote that they can't get to them by any means other than the camel. And in these villages, the camel is more than just a zoo animal. It is an essential beast. It provides transportation. It provides labor. It provides milk. It provides meat. They even take the dung, they dry it out, and it provides fuel. And now they've strapped tents and books and materials on them, and they bring caravans into remote villages and set them up, and they set up literacy sessions between parents and children. So now the other essential attribute of this camel is learning. Right? So what are we going to do with our buildings? Do we need a building? What about this? This is a service that happens in Gutenberg. It's happening all over Europe. It's called the Prejudice Library. So you've probably seen some really cool things where you can check out people. Check out a fireman, check out an accountant, check out whatever. Here you can check out a prejudice. Have never talked to a gay person? Check out a gay person. In Austria, where I was, there were people there who said, I've never had a conversation with anyone who's black. Check someone out. I've never had, here it would be like, I've never talked to anyone who's actually read Glenn Beck. Check him out. I had a student, and God love her. After she graduated me, she called me the first week on the job, and she goes, they stock Glenn Beck and people check it out. I was like, yeah. So it's like, you know, a little culture shock. My point of all of this is a library. The Camel was a library. These facilities are libraries. What makes them a library? Why aren't they something else? Why aren't they experiences? Why aren't they book services? Why is it that I'm sitting in New York with a building, I should be thinking about this? And the answer comes that you need to think about this for a couple of reasons. One, you're not in the book business. If you're in the book business, you suck at it. If you're in the book business, you buy a book, you wrap it in plastic, and you give it to 3-year-olds. This is a bad way to be in the book business. Right? They chew them. They destroy them. They don't keep their value. You're not in the space business. If so, we would have party planning as a required course in the MLS. We don't do it. Why do we have the space? Why do we have the books? Why do we have the materials? Is ultimately because we're in the learning business. We're there to help our communities learn and make better decisions, to succeed and dream and help them assess where they are in that dreaming process. Right? Now, this is one thing for me to get up and say it, and But I want to talk about that. What happened in that castle I showed you before. What happened in that castle was that 52 people from 24 countries got together to talk about libraries and museums in an era of participatory culture. Good God, it hurt to say it. Right? And so we all got together and we all said, okay, what do we do about this? What do we do about the tweeting and the Facebooking? Right? And the inner tubes and all that stuff? Right? I used the Google. I didn't find anything. Right? And what we did is we came together and we said, what makes a library? What makes a museum? So I gave you some of the library examples, and I've got a few more, but there's some rather amazing museum examples. There was a woman in the Philippines ran the Science and Technology Museum. A typhoon came in, flooded it under 8 feet of water. She had staff stuck in the museum trying to get children and other visitors out. They survived. It was the good news. The day after the water receded, she set up shop in the girls' bathroom because it was the only usable structure left in the building and proceeded to raise the $500,000 necessary and rebuild all the exhibits so she could open within a year. These were cool people that I was hanging out with. Director of the Cleveland Public Library, director of the San Francisco Public Library, directors of the Oxford's Bowdoin Library were there. Right? So these are high-powered people, and we got together and we said, all right, what do we do about this? And one of the things we developed was a curriculum. Yay, exciting. I know, I'll keep you awake for the minute, but I want to walk you through something briefly. This is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 parts of a 6-part curriculum. This is what do library professionals and museum professionals need to know. And there's frankly nothing shocking on this list. They need to know about technology. Yes. They need to know about how to sort of professional competencies like ethics and collaboration. Yes. They need to know how to deal with stuff. Yes. They need to understand cultural inputs and sensitivities. They need to know how people learn. Now, what's interesting is you might think that was the new part. But really, that all sort of fits into how we were living in a non-participatory culture. But this is the one that gets me. They said every library museum professional must understand and must have skill in transformative social engagement. That it is not enough to be really good at the building. It is not enough to be really good at the stuff. It is not enough to offer good services. You must be engaging in transformative social engagement. You must be working with your community in transformational activities. Like, you have to understand and be proficient in activism. You must understand concepts of social responsibility. You must understand how to do critical social analysis, where you understand what are the currents and topics, thinkings, values of your public. You must understand advocacy. Librarians need to understand how to organize communities into action, political action and policy action. You must understand how to rally the troops. Understand sustainability of that societal mission so it doesn't just disappear. Understand conflict management. We understand that pretty well. Avoid and run away. Understanding community needs. The point of this is, it's not enough to say, all right, the building's there for the community. All right, we understand that the community can produce information we can put in the library. Fine. Now we have to really say, why are we even doing this to begin with? And the answer is, you're there to make the community a better place. Not a happier, funner, got a building with ivier place, but a better place. One with more opportunities, one with more social justice, one with an understanding of what's going on in the world. I'm going to give you a few minor examples. How many of you have seen a sign remarkably like this? Usually by a copy machine. Notice, the copyright law of the United States, with the title and section code, governs the making of photocopies and other reproductions of copyrighted materials. The person using this equipment is liable for infringement. What does this sign say? This sign says, don't. Don't infringe. But now put a sort of transformational hat on it. What this sign says is, I'm only telling you half the story. Half of the story is what you're not allowed to do. The other half of the story is what you are allowed to do. So why don't we add a separate sign that says, but let me tell you about fair use, right? And the Creative Commons, and where this copyright law comes from, and what that copyright's happening, and what impact that copyright has had on society. The fact that the Walt Disney Company is one of the largest donors to political presidential campaigns every season is pretty important. The fact that they've managed to keep Mickey Mouse under copyright for that many years is pretty important. Are we okay with that? Now, the answer may be, yes, we are, because we live in Orlando and it's working for us. But on the other hand, are we okay when they go after the third grader who drew Mickey for his class project? And you go, wait, that's fair use. How do they know? Do you teach them that? Do you teach them what their rights and responsibilities are? Do you teach what it means to do this, or do you simply say, better watch out. Better toe the line. How about this one? I love this one. The FBI has not been here. Watch very closely for the removal of this sign. I am very, very proud of this organization, this profession, that when the Patriot Act came around, we stood up. We didn't win, but we stood up. We raised an important discussion. We had that discussion. But let me ask you something about privacy. What do you do in a transformational way? What do you do that goes beyond simply saying, watch out? For example, how many people think privacy is a good thing? Seriously? Come on. How many people think, this is the interactive portion of our day. How many people believe privacy is so important, that you eliminate records from the integrated library system, circulation records from the ILS in short term? A couple of you? How many people actually go to the point of telling people that they can be tracked on the internet? Now, let's add all those together. Do you actually tell them that while you may not preserve the records in your integrated library system and on your sites, every keystroke they're putting into the system can be tracked, recorded, and reported by the internet service provider they're using? Do you go to the point of telling them about things like Tor, which is a way of anonymizing web browsing? Do you show them how to install software so they can't be tracked? Do you show them how to anonymize things? Or do you simply say, privacy is so important, we're not even going to give you a choice. We're going to eliminate things, right? We did a set of papers about teaching and learning credibility, and we determined that a K-12 school is the worst place ever to teach kids about credible information, right? Why? Filters. Now, I don't care if you love filters or hate filters. We're not going there. But what you have to admit is when you teach people about good information and bad information, it helps to show the bad information, right? And so with filters, you don't have that option. You can sort of say, right, and why? Well, because no one in, like, a parent-teacher group gets up and goes, we need more crap in our schools. I want the library to buy garbage, and I want it to buy lots of it and fast. We don't do that. But that's what we need. We need to be able to take them to the Martin Luther King website put up by Stormfront and say, look what's happening here. And when it's filtered, we can't do it. Activism. I'm not asking you to be anti-Glenn Beck or pro-Glenn Beck. I'm not asking you to get on the picket line. I'm asking you to take your values and think of them not as a passive thing where you use them and you set up your space to use them, but you have a conversation, a real active conversation with your community. Let's kick this up a notch, as they say. We're working on a project with Polaris Library System for a community information system. So I've said it before, I'll say it again. Your collection is not your books, it's not your materials, it's not your DVDs, it's not your licensing agreement, it's your community. And if you don't spend as much time on your community as you do on your stuff, you're not doing your job. Right? We have to talk about, now, frankly, weeding the community might be a little extravagant. While we've all wanted to do it. But rather than worrying about collection development, we need to worry about connection development. Hey, you're looking at this, you're looking at this, maybe you guys can get together. Hey, you have common interests. Hey, can we pull this thing together? Knitting bees and gaming clubs are examples of us doing that. This is a system where you can now put in local community information. Red Cross, you can put in what's going on in the Boys and Girls Clubs, and you can enter right in the integrated library system. So when you search for things like vampires, you'll get the blood drive. I think this is a good idea. Right? But this is step one. Step one is that we can have librarians get community information, their events, their contact information calendar, and they can put it right in the catalog. That sort of takes us the catalog from our tools to a platform for the community. Right? Step two is, well, if we can do that, we can let the community go ahead and directly enter the information. And there are going to be policies here. Like, for example, are you going to let commercial organizations put their information in or not? Are you going to let government agencies? What about religious nonprofit? You can work that out within your community, but the point is they can keep their information up to date. Step two. Step three is once we have that information, once we are the platform, we can then broadcast it out to the rest of the community. Right? So the community is entering this information, and I can't tell you the number of projects I've seen recently that want to build an iPad app so that when you stop at a bus stop, it says, what's going on here? It says, there's a lecture series, there's an art installation, there's a chili cook-off, there's whatever. And that's all being pulled directly out of your library catalog. Your community can provide it in. The community is your collection. Here's a way that you're now taking your collections and you're pushing it out. For example, why not take small organizations? We had a great organization in Syracuse. It was called Luke East Soul Foundation. It was a tragic story where this couple's child died of a rare disease. And they started a foundation to work against the disease. And then they decided Syracuse was building a children's hospital and they wanted to raise money for the children's hospital. So they had a golfing event. They had all these events. They didn't have a web page, and they didn't know how to put up a web page. They didn't know what a URL is and how to put it. Why can't they just do it within your infrastructure so if you want to know about Luke's Soul, boom, they land there. And meanwhile, we can push not only community information, but library information as a virtual branch out to things like the local startup company. So startups are going to save us all, if you haven't heard. Everyone's going to start a company. If you haven't gotten your $200,000 venture capital by the time you leave the room, you're behind. But we in Syracuse have lots of these. We have tech. I mean, like, the development agencies are literally tripping over themselves. Every, you know, young, fresh undergraduate who holds a smartphone is a potential. Get them. And so they sort of cordon them downtown. And one of the things, we have great programs at Syracuse. It's called, we have a whole entrepreneurship suite. One is, what's the big idea? And then we go from idea to startup. And then we go from startup to a sandbox where they actually start it. Mike Duretta, who's on the faculty, does a brilliant job with this. But he came and he talked with the sort of library science-oriented folks and said, but there's one problem. They come up with great ideas that have been done. It's like they don't know how to, you can fill this one in for yourself, search for existing information. And we're not talking like going in and doing Boolean searches, right? We're talking about going to Google and putting in t-shirt with brick on it, right? And so now what we're doing is we're sending students down, but the library is actually going to be embedding databases, search systems, tutorials right in the Entrepreneurship Center, right in their tools, right in their gateways. Because this is not a destination, it's a platform. Right? So this is not your mission. This is getting lost in the tools to your mission. This is not success. The more stuff, the more budget, the more books, the more stacks, the more hoarding we do, does not let us win. Let's face it, this is becoming the less and less valuable every day. Now, I want to be careful. I understand there's a social safety net feature. I understand not everyone can get their Kindle Fire and can buy their books. I get that. But at the same time, do you know how much a Kindle costs now? 119. You know how much a Kindle is going to cost in 3 years? I promise you, they will be giving them away. Why? Because they want to sell these. No, they don't want to sell them. They want to lend them through our library. That's why OverDrive made that deal. How much data do you get from OverDrive when you lend a book? Oh, that's right, nothing. How much data does Amazon get on the people that they lend the Kindle? Oh, that's right, everything. Right? Now, you can become an Amazon Premier member, and you can borrow books. Not any book that anyone would want to read, but you can borrow books. Oh, no, they're going to put libraries out of business. Stop. This is not your mission. This is not the most valuable asset your library has. First of all, you are the most valuable asset that that library has. You are the people who understand how to work this, but understand why this does or doesn't work. You are the people who can work on talking with them, on connecting them, on doing things that have nothing to do with books and materials, because these are just the tools to let us accomplish. This is our mission. The mission, your mission, is to improve society. Feel free to just stop it right there. Through facilitating knowledge creation in communities. Now, it drives me nuts. I recently had a very interesting online conversation, and my students were unfortunately forced to do it too, with someone who felt that improved society was not the mission of librarians. In fact, it was an arrogant statement. Who the hell are we to tell the community how to improve? Who gave librarians that power? How do librarians know better than anyone else how to make society a better thing? Now, one, I would say, give us a chance. We certainly couldn't do worse than who's running the show now. But the answer is no one. The answer is, we work with our community to define what improve means. In Utica, it might be economic development. In New York City, it might be good reading groups on advanced topics. In Syracuse, it might be recreation or youth violence or whatever it is. What are the topics we want to tackle? That room full of books won't tell you. Only you working with your community in a conversation with your community, understanding their needs and their dreams, only you can make that happen. And how are you going to fulfill that mission? Well, your mission is through knowledge. Is that a book? Maybe. Is that a conversation online? Maybe. Is it a video? Maybe. Is it just someone to listen? Maybe. Is it a place? Absolutely. Library is a place. Library used to be defined as the tools that librarians needed to do their job, right? We need these encyclopedias. We need these ready reference guides. We need these compact shelving and microfiche and God only knows what. It used to be if you wanted to take the library to someone, you had to put a diesel engine in front of it and drive it to them as a bookmobile. Right? Now, if you want to take the library to someone, it looks remarkably like this. Maybe that's not everything, but it's enough to get you started. So we don't need all that space anymore. You know who needs that space? The community. It becomes the trusted third place. It becomes the place where they can collaborate. It becomes the place they can get away from. It becomes, back in Dallas, where they're redoing these libraries, one of their main proponents of it is actually a real estate developer. He wants to gentrify this neighborhood. He wants to anchor it with a library. And when you ask him, you say, why do you want a library there? Is it because you really want great access to books? Now, we've trained these folks so well that he has to spend 5 minutes talking about how he loves books before he says no. Right? Let's face it. If you're, I think, what was it? Commissioner of Education this morning's talk was about loving books. Right? It's like public libraries. We are so screwed because we can't do anything that's not going, oh. Right? What do? We teach kids to read. Oh. We help seniors, you know, meet up with other seniors. Oh. Right? It's like this lovely, squishy thing. Right? But what we really do is we challenge the community to be better. Right? So, I don't even know where I was going with that. I just wanted to get the cue to doing the nine. And anyway. This is what we're trying to do. We might do it with books. We might do it. Oh, place. There we go. They need that developer was saying, we don't need it for books. We need it because we're building the place they live. We know there's a place they work. We know that there's a place that they shop. We need a place for them to be a community. And for them, that's the library. So the neighborhood they're redeveloping that's artistic and full of lots of local art scenes, they're building galleries into the libraries. They're building studio spaces into the library. In places where it's much more about music, they're building performance halls into the library. They're building them around the community. Remember all those pictures I was showing you of Zambia and all that? These things are going to look different from community to community to community. Why? Oh, no, it'll confuse our community. The hell it'll confuse our community. It'll look like them. They'll walk in and go, this is me. It's our job to worry about how it works behind the scenes and how those collections move and all that. We will be the commonality. Let the libraries, the physical facilities, the communities be themselves. So one of the things I wanted to call out, and this is not sucking up to the president, but Sue and Lauren and Fayetteville Free Library just got a grant to build a fab lab as part of the Fayetteville Free Library. Now, if you don't know what a fab lab is, I should probably have you say what a fab lab is. What's a fab lab? The community is a collection of machines and tools for people to build things. So when you have a great, brilliant idea, you get, it's like, I would like to build the next great device. Here's a book. Right? I would like to know how to build a planter. Here's a dummy's guide. Right? No. Here's a bench press. One of the first things you're getting is a 3D printer. You can literally design something on your computer, hook it up, and it will print a three-dimensional solid object. Doctors are using this to literally print bones, all right? Not this particular model, but you know, you get the point. Right? And they're going to run into, well, why is that in a library? Why would you do that? Because some knowledge you can't read about. Some knowledge you have to print. Some knowledge you have to get your hands dirty with. In Nopal, North Onondaga County Public Library, they built a garden. You want to know about gardening? Come with me. Here's a hoe. Tell me that's not more interesting than, and then in the winter, what season are you in? Right? You want to worry about water. You want to worry. They were talking at one point, one library was going to build paths behind walking paths so that if you looked up, you know, exercise in the catalog, the answer would be turn around and go. Right? That's like a trail with a barcode on it. Meg Bacchus, I love Meg. She works at Nopal. She brings in her dog. She calls it the library dog. She's barcoded the dog. She calls it, wait for it, a bark code. And you can check out a dog. Now you go, why do you want to check out a dog? Do you have kids? Do they want a dog? Do they know what they have to pick up from a dog? They can. Here's a dog. Right? Some seniors come in, they just want a dog to sit. What a fabulous idea. Right? Some things don't fit in a book on a shelf around a table. Some things are in your mind or in the community. Some things are virtual. Some things are real. That's our mission. That's our job. That's what we're trying to do. So let me tell you two stories and then I'll shut up. Yay! All right. The first story I want to tell you about is when I was in Austria, I've been talking about this for a while, the Arab Spring in Egypt. I'll tell you the story in a moment, but I sort of wrote it up, and I actually now met someone from the Library of Alexandria, and I like showed her the thing, and I said, is this semi-right? She goes, no, it's much more interesting. In Egypt, in January, they began having protests in Cairo. They began having protests in Alexandria. They began protesting for liberty, equal justice, and social equity. Thousands upon thousands of people protested. On January 28th at 6 p.m., after someone had opened all the prisoners and released the murderers and the rapists and the looters onto the street, all security in Alexandria withdrew. What happened after that, through looting and through deliberate acts of the protesters, is a destruction of property. The protesters went from government building to government building and they burned them to the ground. They were wrecks. They were hulks. Then they turned and they looked at the new Library of Alexandria. Now, what you have to understand about the new Library of Alexandria is it was built by Mubarak 9 years earlier for $216 million of the people's money. Mubarak's wife was on the board of this. If there was any government building that was more closely associated with a person they wanted stepping from power, I couldn't think of it. And so the looters turned their eyes to the Library of Alexandria. And as they started going towards it, a protester pulled up the bullhorn, said, "We must protect this building." And young protesters and women and children joined hand in hand and surrounded this library and protected this library. And by the time an end of the protests, not a window was broken and not a rock was thrown at a wall at this library. Now, what's important about that story is not only do they, oh, I just want to quickly, the sign that this protester has in his hand. Oops, not that one. This says "down with the government" in front of a government library. But they wouldn't let it touch. What they did, in fact, after the protest proceeded, to show you some of the pictures that she sent me on this. This is prayers. They came the next day with a 30-foot-long flag and said, "Can we put this on the steps?" And they said yes. They draped the protest sign on the steps of the library. And every day when the protest began, the protesters would touch the flag as they would go off to protest. What they did in 9 years, those librarians, was they provided such good service. They provided such to the needs of the community. They became so integral to the community that in that moment when they protected the building, those people retook the library. In fact, what's amazing at this point is the library is the best internet connection in Alexandria. And now after the protests, cab drivers, grandmothers, people are going in because they've heard of Facebook and Twitter and Flickr and they want to see it. And the library is the place to do it. Right? This is, you're looking at this and going, well, that's great. All right, I see it. The camels, everyone, this is exceptional. These are exceptional people in exceptional times. And I disagree. Because to talk about them as exceptional means they are above and beyond the norm. They are different from us. I think this is the bar that we need to go towards. This is what we're trying to achieve. This is what I expect of the students that we produce at Syracuse. This is what you need to expect of yourself. And this is what you need to expect of the people you hire. And you sit there and go, yes, well, great, Dave. If a revolution ever comes, I'll worry about it. Have you seen this picture? Occupy Wall Street, occupy Boston, occupy Oakland, occupy Rome, occupy whatever. You know what they're building in the middle of these temporary encampments? Libraries. In Boston, Simmons students are going before and after classes to man the libraries. Librarians are volunteering in them. They're bringing resources. They're bringing books. They're bringing connection information. They're bringing their expertise. They're bringing librarianship to the protest. Now, once again, I'm not going to ask you to take a stand on the politics, but what I want to say is that we do live in times where revolutions do occur. And in fact, what I think we need to strive for is making sure that we have revolutions on a regular basis within our communities where they come up with whole radically new and better expectations of themselves. So I'm not going to talk about why these are exceptional people. I'm going to talk why these are not exceptional people. Why these are the new norm. These are librarians from throughout the state of Illinois. And what they went through is a program called I Lead You from the State Library of Illinois. And they went through three intensive three-day in-person sessions where they worked on projects. And I want to tell you about a couple of the projects to say this is the kind of thing that talks about our mission and what we need to do and why we're doing it and us as publishers. First one is called Transform You. These librarians realized, as many of you do, what was the stat I just saw? 60% of librarians helped someone with an employment question this past year. I'm actually surprised it was that low. These folks said, you know, when people are coming in, we can show them Monster.com. We can help them apply online. But there's something else going on. These people don't just want to find a job. Many of them want to talk about how do they reinvent themselves. For some of them, it's finding a job. For some of them, it's going back to school. For some of them, it's shifting into whole new lifestyles. It's starting their own business. It's starting whole new ventures. It's becoming an author for the first time. Many people are looking at it at desperation, but many people are looking at it as a chance to reinvent themselves. And so they built a program where you can go in and they're starting what they call Transform U campuses in libraries all over Illinois where you can come in. You have a place that you are respected. You have a place where they will help you apply to college. They have materials and manuals where they're training librarians, not to simply be people who can point to Monster, but by people who can counsel and talk about the opportunities and help them engage and connect throughout that community. In Eureka, Illinois, which is not a big place, right? Rural Illinois, we all think of Chicago. But remember that Southern Illinois is on the border with Kentucky. Right? Rural Kentucky, rural Illinois. This is the level we're talking, you know, coal miner's daughter kind of stuff here. Right? A woman came up and said, went to the library. She came to the librarian and said, there's not enough places to have lunch in Illinois, in Eureka. And I'm a certified commercial chef. Can you help me figure out a way to do this? And you know what they did? They didn't say, here's a book on commercial chef. They didn't say, that's great, let's see if we can find someone. They said, here's a corner of our building. You got that. Every Wednesday, come in and serve lunch. And then it turned into every day. And then they went and she started her own business and they went and got grants for the Rural Library Association of Illinois to do this in other places. My point is that we as librarians need to expect more of ourselves, more of our institutions, and our communities need to expect a hell of a lot more from us. We can't simply say that we are not, that we serve and we inform. That we sit back and wait for people to understand. That we share information and provide resources. We can no longer be passive and neutral and stand on the side and hope society gets better. We can no longer wait for some diffuse impact of if we get more databases and resources, somehow that will change the world. We're done with that. We must be active, we must be proactive, we must be within those communities, we must be engaged in those conversations. We build fab labs not because they're cool and nifty, but because our communities need to understand invention and building and that they can construct the world around them. We start entrepreneurship programs not by sending them books, but by helping people become entrepreneurs. We teach innovation by putting people in situations to innovate. We as librarians are transformative social agents. We work with our communities, we understand, we talk with our communities, not simply to inform them, but to make them better. And they define what the better is, but we have the skills to get them there. We do that with our buildings, we do that with our collections, but we do that primarily with our own skills and our own initiative. If you are looking to impact the community, you cannot do it through your shelving. If you are looking to make the world a better place, you can't do that by closing the doors at 6 o'clock and saying your job is done. To be a librarian, to be the greatest and most noble asset that we have in an information world, in an information economy, is to stand up for our communities, is to be proactive, is to be a change agent. And what I saw in Illinois, and what I saw in Salzburg, and what I saw in the streets of New York, and what I saw in Egypt, and what I see here is hope that we can make that happen. If you want to assure that this profession exists, if you want to assure that it doesn't simply survive, but it thrives, you will not do it through your collections and your systems. You will not do it through your buildings. You will only do it through dedicated personal action, through conversation and communication, by being radical change agents within our society. That's our mission. And that's our skill set. And that's our calling. And that's what we need to take on. Thank you very much. Sure.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes. If anyone has questions for Dave, fire away. I think we're all so busy eating the dog that you just shared with us. We're ready to go.
There was a, anyone ever watch The West Wing? Love that show. There was a scene where a Democratic staffer and a conservative staffer were sitting there talking, and they were talking about gun legislation. And the Republican staffer finally turned and said, "You know, I am tired of hearing you liberal Democrats talk about the NRA. Do you know how many people are in the NRA? If every one of you joined the NRA, you could vote it out of existence. What the hell?" I think sometimes, and why I have such great hope, is that I'm finding more crazy radical change agents. And the voices of the conservative folk, now mind you, they may be sitting in the back running away from me, but we're now to the point where we need to recognize that that bar is being raised. And I think, so for a long time, we would come to sessions like this and we would see, oh, Facebook, that's radical and cool, let's do it. Or, and you know, there was that whole library 2.0 language, there was a lot of venom in it, but it was also a lot of interesting thinking. But we sort of said, oh, that's innovation. Wait. That's innovation. Wait. There's innovation. And we treated it like the exception. Oh, I mean, if you've done this, oh, so-and-so, there, Sue's a great librarian. Oh, I can't believe they somehow managed to find one in Onondaga County, right? we have other great ones, too. The trick is that we need to be seen as the norms, and other people aren't living up to it. Right now, I think there's too much. We have our own stereotypes. Sometimes that conservative, bun-wearing, whatever librarian, we hold it even more than our community does, and we need to stop that. We need to expect it. I told you, one of my fears is, this is the message, so I told my students not to come today because they hear this all the time. And my worry is that they're going to get out and they're going to run into people that, and this was a quote given to me by someone in the Urban Library Council, the field will beat the testosterone out of them. That they will be put into situations where they'll be pulled down, where they'll be saying that, no, we're not going to do it. And what we need to do is equip our students and then all of us with these stories. Whenever I go and, you know, my other talks, I give the very specific, do this service. And the question I always get is, can you please give me 5 other examples of libraries that have done this before so that I can contact them and convince my board it's okay? And the answer now is, no. You're number one. You'll be number two, right? That's the kind of attitude that we need to get. We need to tell our stories, and we need to simply begin expecting this. And the other thing we've done is we have trained our communities. I say we. We have. Over 50 years, we've trained our communities what to expect from a library. Right? So that when the Fab Lab goes in and they say, that's great, why a library? That doesn't come out of nowhere. That comes out of the fact that for 50, 60 years, we've defined what a library is. And we've done it to ourselves. How many people in the annual report put circulation statistics? Right? How many people put acquisition numbers in? How many people put any gate count? And how many people are now sitting there going, oh, shit, they're going down, right? We've set that up. We've set up what boards should expect from us. How many say, you know, our gate counts are down, and that's a great thing because our virtual count's up, and that means people are using us from their own home and they're more embedded. We need to tell that story and explain it, right? So we need to prepare our students. We need to expect it of our employees. We need to teach our boards to expect it from us as well. And we need to do that by telling our stories and by documenting them and putting them together. PLS, I mean, part of the reason we have these conferences is to share those stories. We should think about what's a really effective way to document them so every one of us can go back to our boards and say, this is what we're doing tomorrow and why. Please. You're wearing a bow tie, man. You get the first in line. Bow ties are cool. That's the beginning of a but statement.
But now I want to ask you, over 100 years ago, the American Library Association put together a collection of answers to the question, why a public library? And they asked Dewey, they asked Dana, they asked Ewens. So, considering the passion with which you presented this information to us, I'm going to ask you, in 2 minutes or less, why a public library?
A public library is an essential societal democratic institution, which is a highfalutin way of saying that if we believe that we are...
They said that 100 years ago.
So they did.
Give us something different.
I like that. I'm okay with that. I mean, I'm okay with that. The fact is, I think that mission I threw up before, I think someone in Alexandria probably said it. They got up and they said, yeah, we're not in the scroll business. We're not in the cuneiform tablet business. We're in the knowledge business. I'm okay with that, right? What the problem is that people look at it and they say, yeah, but you're not the institution to do it anymore. That's the problem. Or that you have the wrong tool set to do it. And they're right. That our tool set is what's updated. Our tool set is now we promote democracy through learning. Our core of what we do is learning. Dewey did say it 100 years ago. He said the public library is a co-equal educational institution to the public school.
It's the fact that he was a misogynist.
Anti-Semite, yeah. Well, but he was also a slightly balding, bearded professor from upstate New York. So Dewey 2.0, you know. So I'm okay with that. But I'll tell you, let me turn it around for a second. So on my whirlwind trip, I was in Boston talking to our board of advisors from a bunch of people in really nice industries and J.P. Morgan Chase and Accenture and all this other stuff. And I had to present on the library science program because somewhere in the back of their mind was, all right, Syracuse, you teach information managers and tech people. What the hell are librarians doing there, too? And I said, we are the people who can help organize information, large data sets. We can communicate, right? All the stuff we talked about in e-science. They said, oh, we get it. We buy it. We love it. Don't call them librarians. Because we bought it right up to the point where you put the word librarian, and then we went right back to when we were 9 years old into that place that was full of books. And I'll tell you, I'm the one who wants to retake the term. I'm militant, let's retake it. And then one of them said to me, which is more important, the social good that librarians will do if they enter into the corporate market, or the title they take with them to do it? And that's where I sort of went, So we have, Katie, what's your title? Director of the LifeLinks program at the Literacy Center for Literacy. And you are a? You're a librarian, right? There are many people in industry that do brilliant things, and they are librarians. And if they have that common identity, that may be enough. I'm still trying to work that one through. So I don't think the answer is radically different from 100 years ago. I think people just keep forgetting that democracy is kind of important and needs to be maintained. I'm sorry, yes.
I'm going to throw out a question that's similar to one that I asked John this morning. My name is Laura Tindall, I'm from the Chester State Library. We have a nice, perfect financial storm coming, pulling out half our tax base. With this, we engage the superintendent of schools, places like the National Labs, our community, and are redefining the use of our library to replace things that are being lost by the loss of this tax base, such as tutoring, enrichment, larger scale programs that we want to bring in that involve all the community members, not just your community. So as we go forward with this, and this is what I asked John King, I can get a start and I can bring it in. But when I need to continue it, where can I find grants that are creative in which we can continually tool this? Because you know, the school said, we'll give you our microscopes. Nobody's using them.
Right.
We can't pay the teacher.
Right. Right.
When we came to National Labs and you have a Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, we'll teach them how to be stewards.
Right.
And then I said, great, this is going to last until April.
Yep.
And then I need to figure out how to take this story.
Yep.
And to amortize it into continual funds to bring in new things.
Yep.
So that we continue serving them. So that's my question. And that's what I asked him. Where can I find these funds? Where can I serve them?
The New York Public Library budget actually went up in the midst of the Great Depression. Many people don't know that. Something they were doing was seen as valuable enough that when they began concentrating services, they put funding within it. So we've had a situation where, okay, we no longer have people on staff to help you fill out tax forms for New York State tax. Go to the library to do it. That Eureka example I gave before, they ran out of money. I mean, Illinois, New York, our budget situation sucks. Illinois, it is beyond tragic. They literally had problems. I keep using the word literally. I'm sorry. But I'm using it the right way, which is means it, they couldn't get respirators for prenatal or for neonatal intensive care because the provider didn't know they would get paid. Right? In that economic climate, what they did was they began closing all of these job services and such, and they couldn't pay the rent anymore. The librarian said, I got a desk for you. And they said, well, we can't pay you the full money, but we have some left. We'll concentrate our service and bring some funding in. So their funding actually went up by concentration of service. But your question is, that's great, till April. And a lot of those aren't bringing money with them. And so the short answer is we need to look at alternative revenue streams. Sari Feldman, outside of Cleveland Public, when she had to close Sunday hours, she instituted a passport service. So if you ever go to get a passport at the post office and you pay your $50, they get to keep it. And it turns out libraries can do it too, not just the post office. And so she made enough money, revenue in doing that, that she could open Sunday hours at the other places. So I want to be real clear, because Corinne Hill also, when she dealt with 30% budget cuts at Dallas, said, I can run a really great library. I can't run the library of 10 years ago. That we need to rethink this and retool and and so this isn't do more with less. There's no more we can do, and there's a lot less that we're getting. This is do different with what we get, and then IMLS looks at funding where they look for library service funding, LSTA from the state library where we're doing technology, local community grant organizations where you're looking at what services that you can provide to the business community where you can provide as a for-fee services. I really think it's a portfolio of mixed revenue. So there are funding models we can go after, community resources, state resources, economic development all over the place, IMLS at the state level, but then looking at how we can mix the revenue. So, for example, going to the school district and go, can you afford to run your library still, or is that something you can outsource to the public library to run? There was a discussion about that in Philadelphia where they had cut their school librarians. Careful. They cut their school librarians to the point. Barbara Stripling will attest that I am a great lover of school librarians. Right? I love school librarians, and every school should have one. But in those schools where they've gotten done a dumb thing and gotten rid of them, let's put a qualified librarian into them from the public service. Right? These kinds of systems, or bring the school librarians together so they're not so isolated so we can help make those cases. What are the kind of services can we provide that way? So I think I'd love to give you the right answer right to this, but it's that portfolio that's going to make it happen. All right. You can yell at me. School librarians want to yell at me. I'll take it. But I do love them. Special place in my heart. Other questions? Comments? Thank you again for your time, then.